Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Today, we'll be talking about the current climate on college campuses as students return to their universities after the summer break and amidst accelerating repression by administrations who are silencing support for Palestinian rights and protecting their political and financial interests. Already at New York University, the administration has essentially placed a gag order on anyone who wishes to criticize Zionism, a political ideology, by categorizing it as a protected identity class. At Barnard College, which is part of Columbia University, the administration this week adopted its so-called institutional neutrality policy and identified the word Zionist as a potential code word that may constitute prohibited discrimination or harassment against Jewish and Israeli students. Palestine Legal says that Columbia University's school year began with the NYPD violently arresting student picketers, demanding divestment from genocide on the first day of classes. While at the University of Michigan, four people were arrested and two were hospitalized after police slammed students into the ground for engaging in a peaceful die-in demonstration. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, a free speech watchdog group, quote, handed Columbia a score of zero in its 2025 college free speech rankings, assessing the university as abysmal for conditions of free speech and freedom of expression, according to the Columbia Spectator. Columbia tied with Harvard University for last place out of 251 evaluated colleges and universities. And last month, the University of California and Cal State systems, which constitute more than 30 campuses across the state, prohibited both Gaza solidarity encampments and the use of masks to conceal identity. Joining us to talk about all of this are two return guests, Bryce Green and Mohammed Abdu. Bryce is a graduate student at Indiana University and is a freelance writer with fairness and accuracy in reporting. He's also contributed to the Electronic Intifada. He was part of a mass student encampment last spring and faced extreme repression by the administration and the police, which allowed and encouraged snipers on the roof of campus buildings directly aiming at students, including Bryce. He's part of a complaint filed recently by the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, alleging that the university's ban on expressive activity outside the hours of 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. is overly broad and violates constitutional free speech rights. Mohammed Abdu is an author and scholar and was a visiting assistant professor at Columbia University's Middle East Institute for the spring 2024 semester and was at the encampment with his students when he heard of his apparent termination by former President Manoush Shafiq, who was testifying before a congressional committee and engaged in an attack on Abdu, joining hardline pro-Israel lawmakers in distorting his words and vowing that he would never teach at Columbia again. Several other prominent figures in academia, including authors and tenured professors Joseph Massad, Catherine Franke, and Rashid Khalidi, were named in the hearing as well, which was called by Representative Elise Stefanik, Congress's principal McCarthyist, who is a recipient of Israel lobby funding and has tried to convince lawmakers that the word intifada, which means shaking off an uprising against occupation and injustice, is rather a call for genocide against Jewish people. For her part, Frankie is currently defending herself against a lawsuit filed against her by two Columbia colleagues who claim that she created a hostile environment for Israeli members of the Columbia community when she publicly discussed the fact that two Israeli students sprayed pro-Palestinian students with a noxious gas during a protest on the Columbia campus in January 2024. Mohammed and Bryce, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
So Bryce, let's actually start with you. Talk about the lawsuit you're a part of, filed by the ACLU, alleging that your university is flagrantly violating the First Amendment, really, you know, in order to provide cover for Israel and supporters of the genocide in Gaza. Talk to us about that lawsuit and the current atmosphere on campus there in Indiana.
Right. Well, you mentioned that Columbia and Harvard are tied for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, their ranking for the campuses that are most hostile to free speech. Columbia and Harvard are tied for first, but IU is tied with a number of other schools for being second, ranking 243rd out of 250 schools. And that's because of things like the university's response to protesters who were against the genocide. Like you mentioned, we had an encampment that the university responded to with snipers, armored vehicles, there were assault weapons that were being brandished, they had drones in the sky, choppers in the sky, riot gear, really, really brutal military levels of force, arrested 57 people, including myself. And the university's response to any ambiguity in the legitimacy of their response was to enact a new policy that explicitly set hard limits about what people could and cannot say, or when people could and could not say anything, and the ways that people are allowed to protest. The restrictions included things like banning people from handing out literature within 25 feet of a building entrance. You couldn't hand out literature on the inside of buildings at all, even if you're a student. But one of the most onerous restrictions was the restriction of any free expressive policy, free expression, between the hours of 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. So what this means isn't that you can't protest, not just that you can't protest, not just that you're not allowed to demonstrate and have a megaphone in the middle of the night. No, it means that any form of First Amendment protected speech is banned. So according to the letter of the law, you're not allowed to say anything political to your friends after those hours. You're not allowed to wear a t-shirt with a political message. You're not allowed to send a tweet from your phone while you're using university Wi-Fi after those hours. That's how the rule is written, but of course that's not how they're enforcing it. Like, they don't care about the minor stuff that we do. It's used to go after people who are protesting against something the university doesn't like. So lately, students and faculty have joined together in organizing protests against this policy, in which students would protest in front of a common area in campus after the designated curfew hour, I guess we're calling it now, and so that anyone there who's gathering, even gathering in a group after 11 p.m., is against the policy. And so the first day of these protests, they targeted myself and a professor for speaking at one of these gatherings, and since then, they have brought the chief of police out to these gatherings. They have the head of public safety. They have undercover officers walking around with cameras, trying to get people's faces just because they're showing up to a gathering after 11 p.m. I mean, this is insane, but it does demonstrate the level of repression that universities are willing to engage in. When students are threatening the status quo, when faculty, when the university community as a whole is threatening the status quo. And so I think the climate here on this campus is pretty dire, but as usual, whenever you have repression like this, you get the reaction of people rising up and saying no. So each of these protests, they've doubled in size every single time. And we hope to continue those kinds of protests in the future.
What's the
Sorry.
timeline for the lawsuit, and what response has the administration given so far, if they've even responded at all?
So the lawsuit was fired almost immediately after myself and a professor were sanctioned by this policy. And the lawsuit is basically calling out the entire restriction as completely unconstitutional and unjust. Now, the legal system's slow, and I'm not a lawyer, so this is my best understanding of how this works. But the court has appointed what I believe is called a special magistrate, which is adjudicating whether or not to issue an injunctive relief against this policy while the legality of this policy is being adjudicated. And so I think that there is a hearing set in the next month or two that will tell us whether or not the university will be able to continue to enforce this policy legally. And based on that, we'll see what the response is. The publicly, the university hasn't said much at all. I think you know, their public relations people have told them that the best thing they can do is be quiet, because in the past, most of their statements have ended up coming back to bite them in the behind, just because of the way that the, you know, that these aren't the smartest people in the world. They're just following the dictates of the people who want the university to be hostile to people who are fighting for Palestinian rights.
Right. Right. And of course, it's meant to send a message to the student body and to faculty that you better just be quiet. Don't even engage. It's not worth your time.
Right.
And yeah, and we're seeing that at Columbia as well. Mohammed, let's turn to you and talk about the lawsuit that you recently filed against your former employer, Columbia University, for wrongful termination. We had you on the live stream broadcast before the summer when Manu Shafiq, who just resigned as Columbia's president, told Congress that you had been terminated, which was news to you. Remind us of what happened and why you're filing this suit instead of just quietly walking away.
So, first of all, salam alaikum and shalom alaikum, and it's a pleasure to be with you and Nora, and thank Tamara very much as well. And Bryce, it's such an honor again to be speaking with you on AI. You know, the irony is the fact that Columbia just recently settled, obviously, with somebody who was a member or a student who was a member of the IOF with regards to the chemical attack, right? And so it never... their lawsuit never even went to the courts. They just settled. But anyways, I feel myself, you know, it's always challenging, you know, reducing oneself to sort of a state of pure archive or a sheet of paper in terms of recounting these incidences, right? To me, justice is a means. It's not an end. And Foucault, who's one of my favorite philosophers, used to say that justice must always question itself. Just a society can exist only by the means of the work it does on itself and its institutions. But James Baldwin, the great James Baldwin, said, ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy that justice can have. I'm hoping, hopefully with my lawyer and my amazing media comms team, to reverse that equation, the truth and knowledge, the very reasons actually that I was hired, my interdisciplinary expertise, will ally in a reversal of this particular formula for justice ultimately to prevail. You know, we're talking about, for me, at the moment, or at least the context of my work, deals, and perhaps this will elucidate further the why the lawsuit and the circumstances of what happened. 532 years of genocide on Turtle Island and the continuation of anti-Black slavery projects, as Idea Hartman would refer to it. Right, the afterlife to slavery projects, if you will. It's not like we don't have Sandra Bland's and George Floyd's and Trayvon Martin's and Michael Brown's and so on and so forth, right? The We Are Muhammad campaign that is supposed to accompany the lawsuit, and I'll speak to, you know, the reason for the lawsuit, is not meant, I'm certainly out to clear my name, there's no doubt about it, right? But it extends farther than that. What they tried to kill is to kill a story, the story of my scholarship and the story of my voice, which is there's no land back in Palestine unless there's land back in the context of Turtle Island. And again, I can elucidate a little bit more with regards to my work in a bit. But the true reasons for the lawsuit is really defamation and hence the loss of opportunity to teach, to learn and work alongside my students and students in general, who I feel in this moment in time, actually, particularly those in Turtle Island, let alone globally, are the most honorable, valiant, courageous, and wholehearted students that anybody would have the honor of actually teaching. And I've been teaching for close to 20 years, let alone my movement organizing on the ground. And I was obviously at the encampment while C-SPAN was broadcasting the congressional hearings that was led by Elise Stefanik or called for by Elise Stefanik. And they drew on two statements from a Facebook post that I think I had written on October 11th. Number one, of course, they stated that I support the resistance. And of course, I state that I support the resistance. And I named the resistance, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Islamic Jihad as part of the axis of resistance or the Muqawama. However, my statement, and they cut the statement that I had written, also noted the fact that I also have strategic differences over ethical political commitments that I don't necessarily share with Hamas, Hezbollah, etc., etc. I'm somebody who writes and argues for a decolonial abolitionist Islam, a Quran of the oppressed. And what I mean by that is a Quran that is anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian, anti-queerphobic, anti-sexist. So feminism, queerness, anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist politics become very important. Whether I'm talking in the context of movements on the left, liberal movements, so-called political Islamic movements, and so on and so forth, right? Or certainly on the right. These are diseases, queerphobia, sexism, patriarchy, and so on, that I don't tolerate, and not in myself, let alone in others. And so they're not something that's exclusive to political Muslim manifestations. And their most crystallized embodiment, as a matter of fact, is in nation states, be it the Zionist entity, a settler colonial entity, just as much as the US is a settler colonial entity, Canada, and so on, New Zealand, Australia, that disseminate these fascistic practices publicly, right? So there is no symmetry or false equivalency, obviously, between a movement that exercises its right to self-defense and statist violence that, or states that possess a meaning or a monopoly over the very conditions in the dissemination of violence. I was never charged with anything by Columbia University. I was precisely, as I noted earlier, hired for my interdisciplinary expertise, which includes comparative settler colonialism, insofar as the Zionist entity, or what is referred to as Israel, as well as the US and Canada and so on. To me, the US is a crusading settler colonial society. It's not a democracy. And the same thing with Canada. Right. So to me, the question of concepts, of terms, of structures, and understanding what these structures are, let alone the debate over what is democracy and what constitutes democracy in modernity, becomes very important. So not only was I hired for my interdisciplinary expertise, but actually there were attempts by members of the faculty as well as students to try and lobby to keep me within or to try and find a position within Columbia, given, again, the exceptional nature of what it is that I teach. And so I represent in so many ways the precarity of academic workplaces, right? And we're not talking only about Columbia University insofar as faculty, but we're talking about students and staff. And I represent that are institutionalized in hierarchical ways. And again, I represent just the precarious part of that. And these settler institutions, if you will, engage in Band-Aid over the time, DEI initiatives. So Columbia didn't even have to do anything per se. It is already done. Academia represents a site of resistance, never liberation. And so the hearing blacklisted me, particularly Manu Shafiq, blacklisted me globally and also tarnished my scholarship, my reputation, and maligned my name as somebody who is anti-Jewish. I'm a Semite as well, so I'm not going to use the term anti-Semitic, and maligned me as somebody who just advocates for wanton violence. Right? And during the congressional hearings, Congressman Rick Allen literally quoted Genesis 12:3 to Shafi and asked her if she wanted Columbia, essentially, to be cursed by God. So Allen and otherwise is stating that anybody who doesn't believe in Israel's right to exist ought to be cursed by God. And of course, Manoush and this whole theater shouldn't astonish anyone, because Manoush essentially refused to meet JVP, Jewish Voices for Peace, or Jewish faculty that argued for the ambiguous defining of anti-Semitism vis-a-vis an anti-Semitism task force. So my post asked readers to think not only about the future of Palestinian liberation that is tied and is in tandem to liberation or in the assertion of indigenous sovereignty on Turtle Island, black self-determination, but how do we go beyond the realm of resistance? Because to me, resistance is reactionary. Liberation is an active stance. As I noted, the second statement very briefly that was mentioned by Stefanik is in relation to my decrying of the false reports that Arabs and Muslims are decapitating the heads of children and being rapists that are based on lies that Joe Biden and legacy media like the New York Times reported and many other news outlets, of course. Right. Of course, Electronic Intifada, The Gray Zone, The Intercept have all debunked these false myths in a certain sense. So my quote from the Facebook post was, the last 22 hours have been ripe with false reports accusing Arabs and Muslims of decapitating the heads of children and being rapists. What do these centuries-old tropes projected onto Muslims since and before 1492 and later on to indigenous and black peoples signal to all of you? So it's a convenient white supremacist, misogynist, savage, heathen trope that was being reasserted. I'm somebody who argues for a no-state solution, and I'm somebody who condemns Islamophobia globally, whether it's manifested with Uyghurs, whether it's manifesting in the context of Hindutva in Kashmir, whether obviously in the context of Palestine, and certainly in the context of Turtle Island, given, again, the historical significance of 1492. So I'll keep it there, and then maybe we can expand on that later.
I mean, what message do you hope your case can send to other members of faculty who have taken a stand against this genocide, who have, been courageously speaking out and who have been met with similar waves of repression? I mean, how important is it for someone in your position who has been teaching, about the history of settler colonialism, and making these connections between, Western imperialism and what we see happening right now in Palestine? What do you hope that that people can take away from how you've been fighting back with this lawsuit, but also being still a very public-facing advocate for Palestinian rights and against this kind of institutional repression?
Thank you for your question, Yanoura. We need to really think very seriously, and that includes the students, but certainly the faculty, because the students, at least certainly the Columbia students, have proven the fact that they understand the difference between mobilization and organization. Mobilization happens around issues. Organization happens vis-a-vis an understanding of structures. So one of the demands in the encampment was land back. It was contending with the gentrification that is happening in Harlem, and so Black self-determination and abolition and so on and so forth. There are different types of faculty too, and certainly there are a lot of faculty that have placed their bodies on the line, and that needs to continue, their knowledge, their bodies, to use as much as possible the matter of the law to fight for justice. So we need to use all the means necessary at our disposal to do so. But we need to also understand that, again, there are different tiers of faculty. There are tenured, they're non-tenured, they're precarious, but there's also staff, right? And the thing with faculty, and I'm speaking generally here, right, that they tend to be less organized than students. They're consumed by interscene rivalries that limits the extent of their support to each other, let alone in relationship to students. And again, we need to talk about these dimensions publicly, not to be dismissive, but rather to address, again, the hierarchies of power and asymmetries of power that exist amongst us. But faculty, definitely, that has been silenced, they need to step up, particularly tenure track faculty. I mean, what does it mean to be a citizen of a country, period, that is on the wrong side of every liberation struggle on the face of the earth, as Audre Lorde had noted? And so far as me, scrutiny has only further emboldened my own position. I retract and I soften nothing in what I intellectually argue or how I say it, for that matter. For me, the youth represent our beacon of hope. They are what me, Abu Jamal, referred to are the arrows that come from immortality, and they're the ones that we shoot towards infinity. They represent a form of discipline and determinism. They have sat down. They have gotten to know one another. They live with one another. They feed with one another. They organize together. Faculty doesn't tend to do that generally. Faculty tends to operate vis-a-vis signal groups. And so the investment that needs to happen by faculty has to also happen at the level of each other as a collective for us to be able to also talk about our differences strategically, politically, and otherwise. But students really represent the spine and the tongue, the whip of a tongue by which we should use to speak truth to power through. I'm proud of all our students, and I will never tire from professing that. And I really look forward to a world in which we could collectively dream dangerously again, because I think the youth are fearless in that way. You had Stephen Shalita, the great Stephen Shalita, earlier or a few weeks ago, and he precisely made that note. They have a sense of justice, an acute sense of justice, right? For me, again, my experience merely, and that of others, it created a chilling effect, but particularly for me, for specific reasons that I was targeted insofar as what I say, insofar as Turtle Island, because I had David Rubin, I had Jesse Waters, and so many others continue to make the bold statement, which is a true in a certain respect, and they do get what I'm after, which is he's not only out to destroy Israel, but also destroy America. There is an element of truth to that, but they miss the fact that decolonization, abolition are not about destruction. They're about actually creation. Abolition is about creation, right? And certainly is decolonization. But it certainly means that if you choose to dissent, if you choose to connect struggles together from a spiritual and ethical and political perspective, you will be punished. You will be publicly humiliated. Your personhood and everything that pertains to you will be online by the powers that be, academic, non-academic, and government actors, and so on and so forth. So this, to me, is more than personal. This extends beyond, in my own analysis, humbly speaking, McCarthyism. This goes to the root of Islamophobia and the continuing crusading project that started in 1492. Columbus was a crusader. A third and fifth of the transatlantic Middle Passage kin and siblings who were enslaved were Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula and west coast of Africa. Columbus, Hernan Cortez were making comparisons between Aztec women and Moorish women, Aztec temples and Moorish or mosques, right? Montezuma was referred to as a sultan. So how can we not talk about spirituality and religion? And this is why a lot of faculty or even a lot of people don't know how to incorporate the element of political Islam and resistance into the narrative, let alone a liberatory Islam, a Quran of the oppressed, a continuation of Malcolm's project in a certain sense, if I may dare evoke his spirit, the shining black prince of arts. So again, students and lay people are not, and faculty are not only struggling against Columbia University in kangaroo courts in this Orwellian post-alternative fact-truth world, right? Or outside institutions in terms of our workplaces. We're talking about factories, hospitals, grocery stores, et cetera, et cetera. We are struggling against a settler state. This is why it was so easy, the threat of calling the National Guard, the evocation of twice the NYPD, and so on. Manoush lied. It was so easy to lie about when I was hired. It wasn't in October, it was in April of, or sorry, the spring summer of 2023. Everything became so easy to brush underneath the rug. And this is the hegemonic narrative that prevails. A negative peace, which is, as Martin Luther King had referred to, which is the absence of tension to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. So this is what becomes important. This is why our youth, our kids, are being exposed to microwave LRAD equipment. This is why sergeants are letting off their firearms in Hinds Hall, and there's no accountability, and a student could have been murdered in the process. So this is how it becomes so easy for Mike Johnson to step on the campus, being surrounded by the founder of the Proud Boys, all spewing racist Jim Crow outsider agitated narratives, as well as at the backdrop of go back to Gaza chants, and students being called monkeys. Without the students, we need to understand, as faculty, we are workers. We are workers. And we need to really internalize that. We're not some elite echelon of the powers that be. I mean, a lot of us play that role, but we are ultimately workers, no different than janitors. And in fact, we wouldn't have a job without the students. And without students, the university and my profession wouldn't exist. So for me, I think faculty, particularly privileged faculty, tenure track faculty, need to embody what Patrice Lumumba had echoed in spirit. Neither cruelty nor violence nor torture should make us beg for mercy. Because we should prefer to die, and we really mean that. I really mean that. With our head raised up high and with unshakable faith, than to cower or to try and acquiesce to whatever scraps, if you will, the dominant order, the settler institution, will place on the table for us. This is about liberation, not only in Palestine, but also here. And so we need to situate our own complicity as settlers. For me, as a person of color, as diaspora, as an immigrant, this is not my land. And I'm living on stolen land. So this is where we begin to unsettle collectively as faculty, as students, and to further build. And this is the beauty about the encampment and the spirit of the encampment that mobilized even faculty. It was the students that mobilized faculty and not the other way around. They created a new society, a different culture, and a way of life, spiritually, ethically, politically infused. But that needs to bear a certain continuity. That's the spirit of Tahrir that was missing in the Arab Spring after the 18 days. That's the spirit that needs to continue on what the encampments teach. It needs to be taken to our neighborhoods. Because this is also not a student thing. This is not a faculty thing. This is not a university thing. We need to be able to cater to our people that are on the streets, that are in our gentrified neighborhoods, and so on and so forth.
Thank you, Muhammad Abdul. Yeah, Bryce, I want to get your reaction to that, especially, you know, talking about how the student movement ignited members of faculty at Indiana University to be part of the encampment. And really how, yeah, why don't we start there?
I resonate a lot with what the doctor just said about the need for the more privileged members of the university community to take on a greater role and to be pushed, and for students to be pushing them. I mean, when we talk about the nature of resistance, especially here inside the Imperial Corps, you know, it's very different than what resistance looks like in somewhere like Palestine, and somewhere like El Salvador, and somewhere like, you know, Iraq or Egypt or wherever in the world. Here, we're insulated from a lot of the violence that really is naked and unaltered in these other areas in the world. But here in the Imperial Corps, where part of the legitimacy of the regime rests on its ability to push violence under the rug, to have structural rather than physical violence, we have a lot of leeway in how we can act. You know, there's a line that people often use, especially these days, is that if you want to know what you were doing or what you would be doing in the middle of the Holocaust, well, then look to what you're doing now. The difference, a major difference, is that here in America, who is responsible for the genocide in Gaza, we don't have an overt Gestapo that's going to break our knees if we get out and organize. We have, you know, at worst, some institutional sanction. You know, you might get fired, you might get kicked out of school, suspended, expelled. I mean, that's something, and that's not to be dismissed. But that should give us a lot more leeway in the way we're able to resist, in the way that we're able to, you know, act against this system that we're so viciously criticizing. And we're starting to see faculty, which is traditionally a, you know, less mobilized section of the university than the students, but we're starting to see them get more and more organized, start speaking out more and more against all of these structures that are destroying the university system, that are destroying free speech on campus, and that are actively supporting the genocide. In the aftermath of our encampment's clearing, when, you know, they had the military levels of force used against students, you saw one of the largest gatherings of faculty at Indiana University's campus. You know, the largest faculty protest, to my knowledge, in its history. You saw massive, like hundreds and hundreds of people outside of the president's office demanding, why is it that you use this military force on our students? That's insane. You should not be able to do this. But notice the difference that got them out here. It wasn't the violence against people that's being done in their name in Palestine. It was the violence against people at home that they knew. And there's a disconnect there, but the act of resisting, the act of putting up encampments, the act of organizing, getting people together, is breaking down that psychological barrier in the faculty's minds and students' minds and in the public's mind. And each of these acts that we're doing is one step towards building a, you know, a more sustainable future for the entire world. I mean, one of the other major constituencies we have in the university, and that I'm a part of and that I've organized with, is the Graduate Workers Union. And that we do have a role as workers to ensure that our labor is not contributing to the immiseration and to the genocide of others. And our graduate union has been extremely active, fighting not only for better wages, not only for union recognition, but also this coordinating committee is putting out statements in support of Palestine. And one of the things that we're discussing this year is codifying a BDS resolution for the union, because we understand that it's not just one issue that links us all together. It's multiple issues, that the same structures of the university, the same you know, Congress people who are putting pressure on the university, the same people who are preventing the union from being recognized are the same people who are in support of bills that limit the free speech of what people can say on campus. And they're the same people who are insistent that the university continues to support Israel. They're the same people. It's not multiple different structures. It's just multiple issues. It's one structure. And the only way that we're going to be able to combat that structure is if these people who care about multiple issues are able to focus their power, their energy, and their commitment against to transforming those structures. And I think that we've been working hard to build something that could combat these structures that we have. I mean, it goes all the way to the top, and it can't just happen in one department, not even one university. It's a cultural shift. But as I keep telling the students, and I keep telling myself, is that everything that we have, every good thing, every positive thing happens because a bunch of people you've never heard of got together and organized for it against the powers that be who wanted them to stop. And so that's what we have to do now.
That's right. And Bryce, this whole attempt by these various university administrations to now police language and try and fit this definition of Zionism that has nothing to do with anything but political ideologies. It's not a protected class. It's not someone's not born a Zionist. You know, these are political decisions that people made, and they can be unmade. But to try and coddle, Israelis and people who support the political ideology of Zionism, and trying to make it into a protected class, and then try and ban anyone on campus. I mean, we see this at NYU. We're seeing rumors of it around Barnard. Other colleges around the country are trying to really force this definition of a political ideology down the throats of very well-educated students who know better, and using it as a cudgel to silence students and faculty. Can you talk about how that's being waged on campus, and whether you see, your colleagues, grad students at Indiana University or the undergrads being willing to be silent about what Zionism is and what it's not?
You know, one of the issues that we have on campus isn't just that the university is structurally oriented towards being Zionist, towards supporting Israel and transforming itself into, a pro-Israel corporation, really. It's that there's also a sizable contingent of students on campus who also believe the same thing, who also vehemently support Israel, who are also, going out there and advocating that the university crack down on the students supporting Palestine. And that's a major problem. But some of them, when you talk to them about what this issue of anti-Semitism means to them, some of them genuinely believe that any talk about Palestine is anti-Semitic and is an attack on them as Jews. I mean, that's true. The same way, people who thought that desegregation was an attack on their identity as a white person. I mean, it's very real. But some of them are more cynical. You'd be surprised at what some of them will just straight up say. I was asking one of the pro-Israel student leaders, friendly conversation, it does happen from time to time, about why they adopt the definition of anti-Semitism that includes Israel, when by any stretch of logic, anti-Semitism has nothing to do with this political ideology, with this state. And she told me straight up, she said, we adopt this definition because it allows us to call people who are critical of Israel anti-Semitic. She's like, but they have nothing against Jews. She said, that doesn't matter. What matters is that we have the political tool to get more support for the state of Israel from the United States. I said, well, in practice, it seems like you're inviting a lot of actual, genuine, dangerous anti-Semites into your coalition. She said, sometimes you have to work with allies in order to achieve your political ends. So in reality, this definition of anti-Semitism has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It has nothing to do with actually combating these negative stereotypes, these awful worldviews, and these prejudices that people do have against Jewish people. It has nothing to do with that. In fact, it actively cultivates them in order to bring about the victory of this political project in Israel. And so when campuses are adopting these definitions, when state houses are adopting these definitions, I mean, some of them, again, might be genuinely ignorant and just think that, oh, this is how you fight anti-Semitism. But I think a sizable chunk of them understand that this is just a cynical political maneuver, a successful one in many cases, to restrict people who are advocating for Palestinian rights. And, you know, many people are chilled by that. Some people who go into these spaces, freshmen who don't know much about the decades-long debates that have been being waged on campuses for forever, some of them are kind of taken aback, saying, I don't want to be called an anti-Semite just because I said that I don't want children to be shredded by American bombs. I don't want to be called an anti-Semite because I don't believe that just because you had the biggest guns and the biggest bombs that you deserve the land. I don't want to be called an anti-Semite for that. But, you know, the facade is sort of breaking. It's become less and less of a potent attack as we've seen this genocide go on. You less and less hear people say, oh, they're anti-Semitic. Oh, they support Hamas. Oh, they want to destroy Israel. And more just denying the facts altogether. More and more saying that, oh, well, you know, Israel's under attack. Not so much attacking the people defending Palestinian rights, but more defending Israel itself, which I think is indicative of the broader state that Israel is in, geopolitically and socially and economically. I mean, they're on the defensive in many ways, despite the fact that they continue this genocide. And so I think that that's the core state of these anti-Semitism smears against students, faculty, and activists. It's powerful, it's potent, but it's starting to be a lot less so.
Yeah. Muhammad, what are your thoughts on how, you know, as Bryce mentioned, I mean, there have been efforts over the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years in at the federal level and at state levels around, you know, university systems to try and codify this definition of anti-Semitism to include criticism of Israel and Zionism. And now they're really going for it. What, you know, at a place like Columbia, for example, which is like, you know, this bastion of, you know, free thought and the exchange of ideas and, you know, people can express themselves politically and individually. Now they're, you know, they're being told that that they can't protest, you know, at all against a genocide. Professors are being smeared, and students are being subjected to this, you know, kind of language policing down the street at NYU. Where is this going?
Where is this going? That's a good question. Sadly, I think things are going to get far, far more worse. And this is not to scare anybody. This is simply for us to be prepared. And I think that that becomes very, very crucial insofar as, again, the question of strategies that we're thinking about and the distinction between strategy and tactic. Because, again, not only are encampments, which are a form of organizing, banned, but now mobilizing is equally banned. Right, which includes obviously direct action. We're talking about masks not being allowed and so on and so forth, as you had mentioned earlier. And this is what I would like the students to keep in mind. The same tactics are not going to work again as they did last year. Now, Colombia itself has ties to the weapons industry, and there's a lot of history there that has been spoken about by so many, myself included, so far as the drying of public funds and why these particularly Ivy League academies have ties to the weapons industry, and so far as funding. So, for example, right, Board of Trustee G. Johnson of Columbia is on the Board of Trustees of Lockheed Martin. In 2022, Columbia Business School had awarded sort of Northrop Grumman CEO Kathy Warden with a prestigious award. I'm not at Columbia right now. I can tell you that the GDL, which is designated as, you know, by the FBI as a terrorist organization, was roaming through the campus of the University of Toronto, because I'm now located in Take Toronto. But then if you were to go back to Columbia, well, there's no issue apparently over Columbia professor Shai Davidai, who's harassed students, put them in harm's way, targeted them online and elsewhere, about his ties and his family's ties to the weapons manufacturing industry. And by the way, this is not, again, me. This is Joshua Frank had written an article about this on April 22nd. So, insofar as Barnard, for instance, right? So I think a few people had circulated this dimension of things, that now Barnard is now encouraging a wide array of diversity of views to promote in their messaging a sense of belonging for every member of our community. So messaging from the president of Barnard or from any division or department of the college, and I'm quoting here, supporting a geopolitical viewpoint or perspective while denigrating or remaining silent about an opposing geopolitical viewpoint or perspective that is opposite is not allowed. So as you know, one of my colleagues or two of my colleagues said, well, I guess if I'm arguing for the stopping of the spreading of nuclear arms, I must also argue or encourage the arms race. Another professor colleague of mine said, well, I guess, you know, if we're arguing against genocide, we should go about and take up the pro-Israeli side and list the obviously genocidal vile quotes that Netanyahu and his administration have noted, Smotrich, Ben Gavir, and so on, like the whole administration, so that we can be fair and balanced. Look, you know, 9/11's anniversary was 2 days ago, right? And the stream I was telling Amanda, who you and I both know, the stream of right-wing conspiracy everything that was on my timeline was, I'd never witnessed anything like that before, you know. I don't know if it was just me or everybody, right, that the Jews did it, right? But this is the irony. But the Twin Towers, I remember there was this one image, and this is what the global intifada looks like by white supremacists, right? And this is why we need to understand that, again, Israel is but a tool. America is leading this war. And any argument, sure, the Zionist lobby, yes, it possesses a certain power. But I'm sorry, it's the Elon Musks, it's the white supremacist sort of foundations, crusading foundations in the society that is allowing it to get and using Israel as a scapegoat. This is not a war between Muslims and Jews. Right, and we really need to get that. But spirituality is part of it. It is a war that Muslims and Jews have been conscripted into, though, vis-a-vis white supremacist, vis-a-vis the white supremacist usurpation of an Eastern tradition called Christianity underneath Constantine. This is why, like, I'm sorry, but history becomes very important. And the weaponization of Christianity in an Eastern tradition is a means and tool of imperial war that was used for genocide over here, ongoing genocide as far as indigenous people, then enslaved black people, and so on and so forth. And then this white supremacist Christianity, it cast an image onto Judaism in the manifestation of Zionism, as well as on Islam in the manifestation of Wahhabism and certain dimensions of Muslim Brotherhood thought. But this is a war, and it includes, of course, it's a genocide, but it's the backdrop of it all is a war. It's a spiritual war, and it's a war between those who want society, the status quo, capitalism, imperialism, settler colonialism to continue as is, and others who are trying to burst, bring forth a different world. And dare I say, a world that goes beyond the multipolarity of, again, a Wahhabi Zionist crusading alliance and a totalitarian Russian-Chinese project. A war that is out to and against borders, that is going beyond the analysis of nation states, that is trying to establish social, economic, political, spiritual modalities of living that were witnessed into the encampments. And that the encampments were a microcosm of. But then we need to extend that vision, that imagination, that again, our youth embodied. Look, when the one lawn was taking over and our students were arrested, most of the organizers on that lawn were on that lawn being arrested by the NYPD. And I couldn't believe it because it was this surreal Tahrir moment that nobody can plan for. And I know there's a lot of contestations with the Arab Spring, but I'm talking about Tahrir now, not Syria, not Libya, etc. I'm talking about Tahrir. And all of a sudden, and I remember that moment, and I go back to that moment, then the students just spontaneously, nobody told them to do that. There was no lead organizer. There was nothing. They just jumped onto the South Lawn. And they just spent the night there in the rain. And the next day they pitched their tents. Most of the organizers were arrested. This is a vision that brought communities, peoples together. So the idea of dreaming different worlds, of thinking even beyond the academy, right? Again, if we're not going to reform the academy, if we can't reform the settler state, if we can't take them over, then what is the alternative to build alternatives to them? And a lot of the scholars like Yiftach and Wen Yang, who wrote in about the third university, there are alternative visions for life. The Zapatistas incepted that in Mexico. The Panthers had a different vision. They didn't covet and vie for the hallways and corridors of power and to become representative politicians and so on. They went, they organized their neighborhoods. They had the free schools, the breakfast programs. And yes, they armed themselves as a means of self-defense because ultimately that is a tactic that isn't a strategy. So the birthing of a strategy becomes very important. The question becomes for us, because there are many strategies that play amongst the many lefts that are playing, right? Is we need to have frank and open discussions and respectful discussions. And what I mean by that is discussions that are also anchored in an ethics of disagreement, in a politics of hospitality. We don't get to invest in one another in each other's relationships. We don't break bread together. We don't spend that time getting to know one another as the students do. And we need to do that to talk about our differences and what we agree on. And how, again, can we fight for what we're fighting for? And what is it that exactly we're fighting against? Is it just capitalism, or is it also the nation state? And having these discussions in a respectful way. So I think that is the measure. I think we need to do what we need to do now, engage in resistance. Of course, I'm not taking away from that and direct action and mobilization. But the problem is investing all our energy, just as much as investing all our energy insofar as voting as a form of harm reduction on stolen land, well, that leaves us with very little energy to go and actually do the building of different worlds. And building is very difficult. It ain't easy to do what the Panthers did or the Zapatistas or what the students did. And again, we're talking about 2 weeks of encampments. Tahrir, it was 18 days. The Zapatistas did it and have been doing it for close to 25 years. So what can we learn from movements all over the world? What can we learn from our elders, Patrice Lumumba, Sankara, Cabral, and so on? Because these are elders, but then their analysis, we need to expand on their analysis. Kwame Ture talked about the importance of being a religion insofar as a revolutionary. Okay, but he never implemented that. That was a project that is to continue. We need to carry on with Malcolm's legacy. So we need to build on what our ancestors have left for us, bequeathed to us, while not deifying as gods, because nobody is perfect. But there's plenty of movement history and movement theory for us to think through in order to birth that different world. So that would be my suggestion to faculty, to students, hold each other's hands, as the Zapatistas say, and ask one another what each of us knows. And that's how you discover that revolutionary horizon together. Humility is the most important thing in this project of discovering that revolutionary horizon. And I hope people continue or begin to embody it when, if they aren't. So nobody has the answers, but this is why humility is very important.
Thank you so much for that. I think that's a great note to end on. Dr. Mohamed Abdu, can you remind us what the website is for the Solidarity Committee that is behind your lawsuit and support?
Thank you very much. And again, it's such an honor to be with you, Yanoura and Ia and Tamara and Bryce. It really is. And I hope one day that I get to meet you in person, my dear. The website is www.wearemohammed.com. And again, I was my comms team that came up with that. And for certain reasons, again, this is not about me. This is about a cause that is far greater than any one of us. But that is the website. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And Bryce, where can people reach you?
People can find me on Twitter at the Green BJ, and people can follow the organizations at IU, the Palestine Solidarity Committee, and the Divestment Coalition under the name IU Divest Now.
Excellent. Bryce Green and Mohamed Abdu, thank you so much for building with me today and each other. And we will, of course, be following both of your cases as they proceed through the courts and through the various modalities here in the belly of the beast in the U.S. Thank you both for all the work that you both do, and we'll see you back on the Electronic Intifada very soon.